This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Nicht warten, durchstarten mit Indeed. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt auf indeed.com/julep. Mit einer Premium-Stellenanzeige wird dein Angebot ganz oben auf der Seite platziert. Für mehr Sichtbarkeit, damit du schneller die richtigen Mitarbeiter findest und einstellen kannst. Und das Beste, das alles funktioniert ohne monatliches Abo oder langfristige Verträge. Du zahlst nur für Ergebnisse. Sicher dir jetzt 75 Euro Guthaben auf eine Premium-Stellenanzeige auf indeed.com/julep. Es gelten die AGB.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Hello and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. So, President Trump has confirmed that President Zelensky will be travelling to the United States on Friday to sign an agreement on the joint extraction of Ukraine's minerals. It's potentially a rare moment of harmony between the two countries after Ukraine's exclusion from negotiations between the United States and Russia to end the conflict, and President Trump calling Mr. Zelensky a dictator. But it's becoming clear that the minerals agreement is far from a done deal. Ukraine is now describing the agreement as preliminary, and Mr. Zelensky says it doesn't contain the post-conflict security guarantees that Ukraine was looking for.
This is just a start. This is a framework agreement. What is important is that this deal can be very successful or it can simply disappear. The big success, I think, depends on our conversation with President Trump. And I very much count on America and its president.
And Ukraine's Prime Minister, Denis Shmyhal, has gone a step further, saying there won't be an agreement unless Ukraine gets those security guarantees. So what is President Trump prepared to offer? Here he is speaking at his first cabinet meeting.
Well, I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much. We're going to have Europe do that because it's in, you know, we're talking about Europe as their next door neighbor. But we're going to make sure everything goes well. And as you know, we'll be really partnering with Ukraine in terms of rare earth. It's a great deal for Ukraine, too, because they get us over there and we're going to be working over there. We'll be on the land. And, you know, in that way, it's there's sort of automatic security because nobody's going to be messing around with our people when we're there. And so we'll be there in that way. But Europe will be watching it very closely. I know that UK has said and France has said that they want to put, they volunteered to put so-called peacekeepers on the site. And I think that's a good thing.
And a short while ago, I spoke to the BBC's James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Firstly, is President Zelensky going to Washington on Friday to sign the agreement?
This is what isn't certain, because I think he is on balance, because President Zelensky today in Kyiv said he wants to trigger a domino of deal. So this is about a framework, as he put it. This is about establishing where America's head is at, he said. He says he's going to go to Washington and he's going to be very direct with Mr. Trump and ask him, are you going to continue support for Ukraine or not? Now, there is a real hope that this will lead to something more, but to be honest with you, I was expecting him to announce something more substantial, because he has long asked for those security guarantees in return. The resources, the means, the military help to stop Russia from breaking a ceasefire in the future. And none of those yet have been agreed. So at the moment, it seems much more like a business opportunity for Donald Trump than it does for Volodymyr Zelensky in terms of the future security of his country. And to be honest with you, Julian, standing there, I had to remind myself that we are at the start of what is going to be a very rocky, complicated peace process. This is about ending a war that is still very much going on. And yet today sounded like a combination of a trade agreement and a business venture. These are very strange times. And, you know, President Zelensky is concerned about selling the future of his country. But there is a school of thought here that this would provide wealth and security for Ukraine in the long term. But to get a return on these kind of investments, we're talking about 20 years plus. So if Donald Trump was expecting to see a quick return, he's going to have to be patient.
That framework minerals agreement contains the phrase the American people desire to invest alongside Ukraine in a free, sovereign and secure Ukraine. That's not good enough for the government in Kiev?
I think all they want to be is a free, sovereign Ukraine. They can hammer out the specifics on how much territory is occupied, and there is a dream of Russia being forced out eventually, either through sanctions or united military action. But if this is something that gives America an interest, Donald Trump a reason to step in, as you've heard there, to maybe protect his own interests, if it is that transactional, then so be it. I mean, of course there is a yearning for peace here. People have had enough of the fighting, the fear, the anxiety that comes with this war, of course. But if you look at what is being said in Europe, and if you look at what President Zelensky is admitting, why he is engaging in the White House in this way, is that everyone still needs America as a military safety net. So if there was a line on a document that pledged America's support if things turned hostile again here, if Russia's aggression was to re-emerge after a ceasefire was signed, then that would be good enough for Ukraine. But at the moment, there is still nothing down on paper, and you wonder what President Zelensky is going to Washington for. That said, today he said, it's important that I meet him. I want to ask him questions, and you'll be sure that he wants to get there before he looks in the eye of Vladimir Putin.
Is Mr. Zelensky hoping that this minerals agreement might possibly open the door for Ukraine to take part in substantive negotiations on its fate?
I think it wants that before this agreement, to be honest with you. But yes, I think is the short answer to that, because at the moment, Ukraine is not even at the negotiating table, as you say. But we're already lacking the security guarantees in this agreement. So I think, yes, I think this is about giving President Zelensky a reason to contact Donald Trump, to try and forge a relationship where the US president is distracted by giving more confluence to Moscow, to Vladimir Putin. He is also hoping that this deal would bring in other European partners as well as a part of collective effort to look at Ukraine as an investment opportunity, to look to America to collaborate in that way, and to also present itself to America as a united front to provide security and business opportunity where America is less willing to do so. So there are all of these things swirling around, but at the moment, we're talking such a long way off in terms of what America is actually going to provide, when clearly Donald Trump has no interest at the moment in policing peace in Ukraine in the long term. So it's a peace process like no other, and we wait to see what the practical realities will be.
That was BBC's James Waterhouse in Kiev. And earlier I spoke to Oleksandr Mareshko, who is an MP with Mr. Zelensky's ruling servant of the People Party and chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee at the Ukrainian Parliament. I began by recalling those words of President Trump, that it was the Europeans who would be providing security guarantees. And also, there'd be a lot of Americans working on the ground, extracting those minerals, that sort of automatic security, Mr. Trump said, because nobody's going to be messing around with our people when they're there. So, for Mr. Mareshko, is that enough?
Well, first of all, this agreement, we view it also as a kind of economic security guarantee, because it enhances our security, because Americans, they tend to support, to provide more support and more, sometimes even military aid to those countries in which they have economic interests, or, for example, investments. So to me, this agreement is a classic win-win situation for both Mr. Trump and for Ukraine. But at the same time, of course, the primary concern for us right now is security concerns, security guarantees, because we want to survive and to guarantee our future. And without American help, it would be much more difficult. And because the United States remains to be the leader of the free democratic world, and we need support of the United States.
Okay, could you be a little bit more specific? I mean, this talk of support and security guarantees is rather vague.
Well, yes. Well, but at the same time, we hope that this agreement will give an argument for President Trump to continue provide military aid to Ukraine because he wants to show the difference between himself and President Biden, especially before his voters. In this way, he's trying to say to his voters, look, I'm different from Biden because I continue to provide military aid to Ukraine, but for something. I have something in exchange for the United States. So this agreement has this political motivation for Trump to continue to support Ukraine.
Okay, so just to nail you down, a commitment from President Trump to continue arms supplies to Ukraine would be the security guarantee that you were looking for.
Well, it's one of the security guarantees. But, you know, when we're talking about security guarantee, we should view it from the perspective of Putin. In other words, what deters him from continuing his aggression and from making another wave of aggression and armed attacks against Ukraine? And the best security guarantee is NATO membership. And we are determined to continue to work with President Trump, trying to persuade him to understand that this is the cheapest way for the United States to help Ukraine to survive and to provide us the only reliable security guarantee.
So if you don't hear what you want to hear in Washington on Friday, will President Zelensky sign this agreement?
I'm not sure about that because, again, this story is about trying to get security guarantees from the United States. But on the other hand, the very fact that President Zelensky and President Trump will have face-to-face meeting is already extremely important because it will remove all these myths, kind of the problems which we had previously because of the Mr. Trump's statements. So it gives us a chance to start a new chapter in our relations, which will be more constructive. And I hope that our president will explain convincingly enough to Mr. Trump why we need NATO membership, why we need security guarantees.
I hope you don't mind me saying so, but this all does seem a little bit the wrong way round. You would normally have negotiations to end a conflict. Once that conflict had ended, you would then enter into agreements with interested parties to mine your natural resources. And yet you're doing this first without any idea of how this conflict's going to end.
Well, I understand you, and I agree in part with this thesis because, you know, when we're talking about developing natural resources of Ukraine, there is a certain sequence of actions. And first, to do that, to develop our natural resources, we need to stop Russian aggression and to return the territories which are currently under Russian occupation and where in these territories we also have our natural resources. So again, this agreement pushes the United States in this right direction to help Ukraine to survive and to liberate our territory. And only after that, we can seriously start developing Ukraine's natural resources.
I want to ask you for a very, very brief answer, Mr. Marechko. How do you rate Ukraine's chances of getting a seat at the negotiating table? Very briefly.
95%.
That was Oleksandr Marechko, a Member of Parliament in Ukraine. And don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but missed the live broadcast, a podcast of the programme is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine, BBC NewsHour podcast, and you'll find it there. You can also subscribe to the feed if you want to receive it on a regular basis. Coming up, a funeral home in China has had to open its doors to members of the general public after the noodle dishes on offer in its canteen became hugely popular.
Even when it first appeared on social media, there was word that people were queuing up to go into this funeral home. They'd heard the noodles were really good, and they were even pretending to be mourners, pretending to have deceased relatives in the funeral home so that they could go to the canteen attached to the funeral home to try out these fantastic noodles.
And the top story from the BBC newsroom, President Trump says Volodymyr Zelensky will visit Washington on Friday to sign an agreement on sharing Ukraine's mineral resources. Mr. Zelensky says he's still looking for American security guarantees. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Residents of four refugee camps in the occupied West Bank have evacuated their homes in the largest displacement of Palestinians since Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967. 40,000 people have left their homes, according to the United Nations. At the weekend, tanks were deployed to the West Bank as the country's defence minister announced plans for a prolonged presence to tackle terrorism, saying residents would not be allowed to return. Paul Adams reports from the occupied West Bank.
I'm looking down the hill here to the eastern edge of Tulkarem refugee camp. It's a densely packed area of houses built right next to each other. But in the middle of it, there's what looks like a street. But it's not a street because there were houses there a week ago. The people in those houses were given 2 hours to come and collect their belongings before the entire area was demolished. When Israel's military operation in Tulkarem began a month ago, camp residents were given very little time to leave. In the offices of the local Palestinian Authority, we found displaced people with a host of problems. Ala Ofi's wife is about to give birth. He needs paperwork but hasn't been allowed home to get it.
The army forced us out. Me, my family, my wife, we took nothing with us on the way out. We left our documents behind, our clothes and everything we had at home.
Israel says the army had no choice but to enter the camps. It's here, the government says, where acts of violence are planned against soldiers and civilians alike. But Tulkarem's governor, Dr. Abdallah Kmel, sees it differently.
It is a declaration of war, and a declaration that oversteps all agreements between the Israelis and the Palestinians. You are talking about an operation of destruction, the financial and mental destruction of the residents.
At the weekend, Israel ordered tanks into Jenin. Clearing the camps, it said, could go on for a year. It's already the biggest operation of its kind in the West Bank for more than half a century. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, donned a flak jacket and went to the West Bank himself to drive home the message.
We're entering terrorist strongholds, flattening entire streets that terrorists use and their homes. We are eliminating terrorists, commanders. We're doing very, very important work against Hamas and other terrorist organizations desire to harm us.
The main road into the camp here in Jenin is a desolate scene. Earth bulldozed to the sides of the roads, shop fronts damaged and huge puddles of water in the middle of the road. These camps have been around for 75 years. They've never been evacuated like this before. Israel says everything it's doing here is about security. But this place is home to more than 20,000 people. And they're being told they may not be able to go home for a year. Around 40,000 people have been displaced. Some families have moved into public buildings. Others are staying with relatives or in rented houses. For the children playing here in the grounds of a charity for the blind, education has stopped. Majida Zoueida is here with her children and grandchildren.
They told us to leave and that they would later tell us when to come back. Up until now, it's not clear when we will be able to return to the camp. We wake up every morning in the hope we go back. However, there's still little hope.
With the war in Lebanon over and the war in Gaza on hold, Israel is focusing its attention on the West Bank. The government says the threat posed by armed groups in the camps is real, but in dealing with it, Israel is doing a great deal of damage. This isn't Gaza, but lives and homes are being destroyed with no immediate end in sight.
The BBC's Paul Adams reporting from the occupied West Bank. Now, the Erlong Funeral Home in China's southwestern province of Guizhou also has a canteen for the mourning clients. But it's recently been overwhelmed by hordes of diners, many of them pretending to be mourners, after a photo of a noodle dish served in the canteen went viral. I asked our East Asia editor Celia Hatton what all the fuss was about.
Julian, you have to understand right from the start that China in general is a country of food lovers, and social media has only amplified this. So when one corner of social media gets wind that something really special is being sold, especially if it's being sold in a random location, that tends to attract a lot of attention. And people almost enjoy the challenge of being able to hunt down a really hard to find, like baozi, a bun, or maybe some roasted meat, you know. But in this case, it was the noodles on offer at the Arlong Funeral Home in southwestern, the province of Guizhou, that got people talking on social media. And that started attracting more and more attention. And even when it first appeared on social media, there was word that people were queuing up to go into this funeral home. They'd heard the noodles were really good, and they were even pretending to be mourners, pretending to have deceased relatives in the funeral home so that they could go to the canteen attached to the funeral home to try out these fantastic noodles.
And noodles with minced pork and peanuts. Is that typical of the region?
It is typical of the region, but I will say, I haven't tasted them, obviously. I haven't had a chance to go to this particular funeral home, but just by looking at online photos, they do look delicious. They look a little bit spicy. They look like they're hand-pulled noodles. They're not just out of a packet. So it does look like something quite special, I will say that.
So the funeral home, the canteen, are they now restricting entry?
Well, they have decided to go the other way. They've decided to give away 50 bowls of noodles for free every day, as long as the people coming to try the noodles try not to make too much of a scene. And they allow the mourners, the people who are actually there to use the services of the funeral home, they allow them to go about their business very quietly. So they're actually kind of giving into this craze, I think, because at one point, it was said that the lineup for noodles was longer than the lineup for memorial flowers. People were waiting up to 2 hours outside the canteen in order to get a bowl of these delicious noodles. So I think the Arlong Funeral Home has just decided they should just go with it.
It sounds like rather a boisterous environment, this, for those who are going to the canteen because they have lost someone.
You would think so. I mean, it was interesting. One person who wrote a review of the noodles online said that he snuck into the funeral home and he was sitting to eat his bowl of noodles in the canteen. He finally got a bowl and he realized that he was surrounded by people who'd been to an actual funeral. And that made him reflect on the fact that life is quite short. So he said that what he decided to do was just to go back and get a second bowl of noodles.
I mean, here in the UK, crematoria, funeral homes, rather somber places. They certainly don't have canteens. Is that usual in China?
It is quite common. I mean, as I said, China is a country of food lovers and having easy access to food is quite important. So you will find canteens in quite strange places. So, for example, if you're in a department store, you might go to the basement of the department store to find kind of a drab-looking canteen dishing out the usual rice and noodle dishes. The fact that this particular canteen served quite delicious food, that's what's really unusual.
That was the BBC's East Asia editor, Celia Hatton. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. There's a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. You're with NewsHour. And the UN's World Food Programme, along with the medical charity MSF, have temporarily suspended operations in Sudan's famine-stricken Zamzam camp in North Darfur due to escalating violence. The agency says it's evacuated staff over the past couple of weeks. The WFP had already paused activities earlier this month after heavy shelling from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces pushed more people into the camp, which shelters nearly 500,000 people. Nairobi-based Lenny Christine Kinsley is a spokesperson for the WFP in Sudan. I put it to her that it was a drastic decision to take, given how dependent the residents of the camp were on food aid.
It is not a decision. It was forced upon us because of the escalation of shelling, especially on part of the rapid support forces, that our partners' staff on ground could no longer safely be in Zamzam to deliver.
But it leaves the residents of Zamzam without any food aid?
At the moment, the population of Zamzam, which is around 500,000 people, is without any form of assistance. And MSF has also been forced to suspend operations.
Before being forced to suspend your operations in Zamzam, can you give me some sense of what was going on there?
WFP had been providing assistance for around 100,000 people in the camp. We're receiving monthly coupons to be able to cook a meal a day for their families. And I can tell you the situation even then is and remains extremely dire. I have heard reports of people just surviving on little or nothing, eating basically the leftover peanut oil waste. We have the food in the country, but it is the conflict dynamics and the parties on the ground that are inhibiting us from being able to help them.
Have you been in touch with the rapid support forces?
We, as an impartial actor, talk to all parties on the ground. And the complexity of the situation in Sudan, and especially in Darfur, is that we're not just talking to the rapid support forces. There are communities on the ground. There are other armed actors. At the end of the day, what that means for us is 50 checkpoints on a 500-kilometer road of different actors of trying to get aid convoys through. The safety, the security, the time that that takes is unbelievable.
I mean, however regrettably you are suspending your operations, to put it bluntly, it is very likely, is it not, that people will die.
People are already dying of hunger in Sudan and have been for months. And the biggest challenge to even understanding the scale and scope of this crisis is access. People have been dying, and every moment of time that we lose equates to lives lost.
Lenny Christine Kinsley, spokesperson for the UN's World Food Programme in Sudan. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Calin Georgescu was the man to beat in a rerun of Romania's presidential elections in May, according to local opinion polls. The far-right candidate unexpectedly topped the first round of the original election held last October, but it was subsequently annulled by the Constitutional Court on the grounds of electoral interference by Russia. Now Mr. Georgescu, favoured to win the rerun, has been arrested on 6 charges, including acts against the Constitution and initiating or forming a fascist organisation. This programme spoke to Mr. Georgescu after he won the first round of November's election. My colleague Celia Hatton asked him whether he had benefited from Russian help.
The only help was from God, this is all.
But you can understand why some are sceptical. You seemingly came from nowhere.
From nowhere? I'm coming from Romanian people. They are surprised because they didn't realize that Romanian people can succeed. And in 35 years, we have just political parties. Yeah, I can understand. But the time is changed. And we discuss about big shift. They cannot understand that could be possible a big shift in this society.
Well, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance raised the cancellation of the Romanian elections as concerning when he spoke to European leaders in Munich earlier this month.
The argument was that Russian disinformation had infected the Romanian elections. But I'd ask my European friends to have some perspective. You can believe it's wrong for Russia to buy social media advertisements to influence your elections. We certainly do. You can condemn it on the world stage even. But if your democracy can be destroyed with a few hundred thousand dollars of digital advertising from a foreign country, then it wasn't very strong to begin with.
U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance. Well, let's speak now to Nick Thorpe, the BBC's Central Europe correspondent. And Nick, I know that you've only just touched down in Bucharest after being away for a while, but if you could help us with any information you have about how Calin Georgescu was arrested.
Yes, indeed. Well, he'd just come out of physiotherapy. He has a bad leg. He was on his way, his supporters say, to actually register for that rerun of the presidential election on the 4th of May, when his car was stopped in the morning traffic in Bucharest by the police. He was asked to get out, and he was taken away by the police to the public prosecutor's office, where, as you've said, Julian, he was charged with these pretty serious charges of against the Romanian constitution.
Now, presumably, the mere fact of being arrested and being charged doesn't disqualify him from contending that May election. But if he's convicted, presumably he won't be able to.
Well, I think knowing the slow procedures of Romanian justice, I think it's very unlikely he'll even have been put on trial for those charges, before the May 4th election. But I would fully expect the Constitutional Court, or perhaps the Central Electoral Bureau, to find someone under suspicion or who's been charged with such serious offences. It seems pretty unlikely that they would allow him to run. There is a precedent for this, just with the before the first round of the presidential elections last November. Another far-right candidate, Diana Sosoaca, was banned from running because she was seen as breaking the constitution or threatening the constitutional order. So most people in Romania tonight are fully expecting that to happen. It's very unlikely, they believe, that Calin Georgescu will be allowed to take part in an election in which he was clearly the front runner.
Just tell us a little bit more about Calin Georgescu and his electoral appeal, how he came from nowhere last year to be the topping the poll in the first round last November.
Yes, well, he has been on the political palette for a while in Romania. He'd been billed before. He'd been supported by the far-right Alliance for the Union of Romanians, but he wasn't a well-known figure at all. So he did effectively, as we've said, come from nowhere. And he does have a lot of backing, in particular from people who are fed up with what they see as the monopoly of power by either the Social Democrats here or the National Liberals, who've pretty much been in power, you know, for the last decades. And a lot of his appeal, I've spoken to many people who support him, who say they don't support him unconditionally, but he's a sort of breath of fresh air. They see him as a different character and someone who would, as they see, upset the apple cart of what they many people see as a corrupt system.
OK, Nick, well, thanks for that. But do stay with us. We'd appreciate your analysis, more analysis in a moment, because we did reach out to Mr. Georgescu and his lawyer for an interview today, but didn't get a response. George Simion is the leader of the far-right Alliance for the Union of Romanians, or AUR, which Nick mentioned there. I asked him first for his reaction to Mr. Georgescu's arrest.
Just a short comment. We are a right-wing party, the main conservative party in Romania. Mr. Georgescu, yes, was arrested today, but he is now in his home. He's under judicial control. We consider it to be an abuse of the current deep state in Romania, of the general prosecutor, who didn't give any proof, not a shred of evidence was presented to the Romanian public about this external financing or about any Russian interference with our elections or about Russian supporting Mr. Calin Georgescu.
Why have you decided to endorse Mr. Georgescu as presidential candidate rather than, say, run yourself? Because as far as I can gather, he's a bit of a one-man party.
He's an independent candidate. I was a candidate representing my party. I finished forth the elections in 24th of November. So Mr. Georgescu was actually voted by the Romanian people. He finished first. So he was supposed to be in the second round against a candidate that represents another sphere of another type of political ideology, the globalist ideology. So we from AUR party, the Alliance for the Union of Romanians, supported Mr. Georgescu because we support democracy and we support the vote of the Romanian people. The current establishment in Romania decided to annul the elections and the second round in December. And now is after 3 months when they didn't present any evidence, not a shred of proof was presented to the Romanian public. They are calling Mr. Georgescu at the public prosecutor's office and are trying to indict him for fighting against the constitutional order. It's very similar with the situation in the United States, where Mr. Trump was arrested 4 times before he won the presidential elections.
Okay. Mr. Georgescu has in the past described as national heroes and martyrs Ion Antonescu, Romania's de facto World War II leader, who was sentenced to death for his part in Romania's Holocaust, and Corneliu Azelia Codrianu, a pre-World War II leader of the Iron Guard, one of Europe's most violent anti-Semitic movements. Those opinions, they don't concern you in any way?
Of course, they are concern, and we don't support such ideas.
Mr. Georgescu holds those ideas. He's described these people as national heroes and martyrs, and yet you don't have a problem endorsing him as a presidential candidate.
No, we have a problem with annulling elections, with not respecting the will of the people, which is actually totalitarian. We have the Minister of Diaspora from Israel, which is a member of Likud, who met with Mr. Georgescu and confirmed they are on the right track to establishing a position, a common position regarding these statements, which are not quite accurate. But I can testify for my party. We are the second largest party in the Romanian parliament, and I can vow for what we stand for and for the future of Romania, which should remain a democratic country.
That was George Simeon, the leader of the Alliance for the Union of Romanians, and still with us, Nick Thorpe, the BBC's Central Europe correspondent. A number of things, Nick. Mr. Simeon said that prosecutors hadn't presented a shred of evidence to the public. I mean, I presume that relates to the previous allegations against Mr. Georgescu.
That's right. I mean, this was as in the clip I think you played, or in an earlier part of J.D. Vance's comments at the Munich Security Conference, Mr. Vance said that he spoke about the flimsy suspicions of an intelligence agency that had been presented. Well, you know, these were presented by President Klaus Johannes at the beginning of December. They weren't only criticized by the far right, also by the centrist Save Romania Union candidate Elena Lasconi, who came second in that election. She was also very unhappy about it being cancelled. She felt she had a chance in the second round and was very upset by these allegations. It's true there wasn't a great deal of substance of it to those allegations, or not so much information was presented by the Romanian intelligence services. But in response to J.D. Vance's remarks, the head of the Constitutional Court just in the last days came out with a very strong interview and said basically that the Constitutional Court, when they cancelled that first round, this was because of what he called huge irregularities around the election, the financing of Mr. Georgescu and so on. And he said it wasn't a decision against an individual candidate, but about the procedure, which he said he had to cancel. That was why the court had to annul that election.
If indeed Mr. Georgescu is barred from standing in the May elections, and given the way that the Trump administration seems to have embraced him, that's not going to be terribly good for either US Romanian or indeed US European relations.
It's not, Julian. And Romania is a key country for NATO and for the United States. You know, just across the Black Sea from Ukraine and from Russia, of course, with a massive base, with very many US assets, several bases, in fact, which are central to US defense military preparations in Europe and, you know, to NATO at the Mikhail Kocalnicianu Air Base. So a very serious moment for Romanian US relations.
Nick, look, many thanks for that. That was Nick Thorpe, the BBC's Central Europe correspondent, speaking from Bucharest. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Syria's new leadership has repeatedly promised to include all groups when it comes to shaping the country's future. It held a conference of national dialogue this week in Damascus, but one big group was conspicuous by its absence, Syria's Kurds. They control an enclave in the northeast, but there are ongoing clashes with militias backed by Turkey, which has long regarded the Kurds as a threat. Complicating matters is the fact that the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces are allies of the US, helping them to defeat so-called Islamic State. The BBC's Diyar Gol has been to Syria's Kurdish-held area.
As we cross the ancient Tigris River over a floating bridge from Iraqi Kurdistan, the minibus carrying us and several other civilians shakes and rattles. We are heading to the Kurdish-controlled northeastern region of Syria. 10 years ago, the so-called Islamic State militants, ISIS, swept through the northeast, reaching the iconic city of Kobani on the border with Turkey. ISIS imposed a tight siege over the city that lasted months. I join hundreds of Kobani's residents as they celebrate the 10th anniversary of their liberation from the terror of ISIS.
You see so many young girls and women holding each other's hands, dancing and chanting in joy. I can imagine they have so many reasons to dance, because if ISIS was ruling this region, I am sure they wouldn't be able to leave their home as a woman.
Not far from Kobani, fighting rages on between the Kurdish-led SDF and Turkey-backed Syrian forces. Turkey sees one large armed component that is part of the SDF alliance as a terrorist organization. It wants to expel the group from its borders. For weeks, Turkish drones have been targeting SDF supply routes. And even civilian anti-war protests have come under attack.
We're dancing, and I was the last one in the row.
This is Leo Bonsi, a 28-year-old German peace activist who has been volunteering at a women's shelter here for 2 years. She was injured in a recent attack.
I actually bumped in the middle of the people.
On her hospital bed, she shows us a video of two projectiles flying down from the air and hitting the ground in the middle of a group of people dancing. The protest was held near a strategic dam where fighting has been ongoing. Human Rights Watch condemned the drone attacks as apparent war crimes committed by the Turkish SNA coalition. But the Turkish government denies targeting civilians and infrastructure, instead accusing Kurdish forces of using civilians as human shields. Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharr, has called on all armed groups in Syria to lay down their weapons. But for the Kurdish forces, who face an existential threat to their presence in the northeast, this may not be an option. Damascus and the Kurdish-led SDF forces have been negotiating a solution for the northeast. But Commander Mazlum Abdi tells me the situation remains tense.
In reality, we are still at war with Turkey and its proxies. Turkish jets and drones continue to bomb us. In Damascus, it remains unclear what steps the new government will take.
In one of Kobani's cemeteries, I join mourners as they bury two Kurdish fighters killed in a recent attack. Stability in Syria may be on the horizon, but for the Kurds, the future is uncertain.
The BBC's Gia Gol reporting from Syria. The White House has stripped journalists of the power to decide which of them covers US presidential events, with President Trump boasting that it was he who was now calling the shots. Mr. Trump's spokesperson said that the independent White House Correspondents Association would no longer have a monopoly on choosing members of the press pool. It's a small group of reporters that covers the US president in often cramped spaces like the Oval Office and on Air Force One, and shares the material with other news organizations. The move comes amid an escalating battle between the White House and the Associated Press news agency, which Mr. Trump has barred from presidential events over his renaming of the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. Gabe Rotman is a senior lawyer with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press in Washington.
The pool is there to serve the public, not the presidency, ensuring that the press itself determines which outlets are covering day-to-day presidential business is essential.
So the suspicion is that the White House is driving for a more favorable coverage of the president.
That would be the concern. The press selects the reporters and journalists who are covering the president in order to ensure that that can't happen, that the president is not able through that selection process to shade coverage one way or the other.
What about the other argument that the way in which the press pool has been selected up until now, that it's obviously favorable to the mainstream media?
My understanding is that the White House Correspondents Association has been pressing for years to ensure that the press pool represents a broad swath of media, you know, including new media. So in order for the pool and the White House press corps to serve the public, you know, and not the president, it needs to be independent from these types of determinations by the White House.
Is it possible to mount a legal challenge against this?
Under the First Amendment in the United States, there's a concept called viewpoint discrimination. And the law basically boils down to the government can't pick and choose sides in public debate. Viewpoint discrimination is so disfavored under the law, you know, the courts have called it poison for a free society.
Is this what Associated Press are arguing as well after being barred from the White House?
That's right. The Associated Press, they brought a lawsuit, and one of the allegations in the lawsuit is that the access exclusions are being driven by their editorial choice to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of Mexico, while noting the president's changing of the name.
Of course, this administration argues that it's very much in favor of freedom of speech, but you would argue that it is doing things that are contrary to that particular statement.
To the extent that it's engaged in viewpoint discrimination, you know, as I say, the courts in the United States have called that poison to a free society, precisely because the government shouldn't be in the business of picking and choosing sides in public debate. In the case of the announcement with respect to the White House Correspondents Association, there, the key issue is independence, that the journalists who are covering the president must be picked by journalists, because the alternative is that the White House can take steps to influence coverage one way or the other, and that's a problem in the United States.
That was Gabe Ruppen from the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press in Washington. The White House never responded to our request for an interview or statement. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.